Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
This week on Behind the Knife, we start our two-part series on rural surgery. First up, we have Dr. Tyler Hughes, and next week we'll be publishing Dr. Gary Timmerman. Both guests will talk on the challenges of rural surgery as well as the pros and cons of practicing in a rural environment. They also touch on the future of rural surgery and what it means for the medical profession overall. Enjoy.
Okay, well, welcome to Behind the Knife. Today we have Dr. Tyler Hughes, who is a general surgeon who practices in a rural practice. He's been at this practice for 21 years in McPherson, Kansas, a town of approximately 13,000 people with a surrounding population of 30,000. He is a has one additional provider, and they are alternate calls every other night. Of note, he is chair of the Advisory Council for Rural Surgery for the American College of Surgeons. He's the at-large director. He is an at-large director for the American Board of Surgery, and he previously has served as the assistant program director for St. Paul Medical Center in Dallas, where he also completed his residency. Welcome, Dr. Hughes, and thanks for joining us on Behind the Knife.
It's my pleasure.
So, Dr. Hughes, one of the reasons we wanted to get in contact with you and talk to you is there's been some articles published recently referring to the need for surgeons. One stat that I recently saw that said in 1980, we trained 945 general surgeons in the United States. And in 2008, there's 972 trained, but even though the population has increased by 79 million, and they refer later in this article to the more subspecialization of surgeons and kind of staying closer to the bigger cities, and that we're going to have a large deficit in our rural areas, which is actually a majority of America. How did you become interested in rural surgery? Did you have exposure to this during your residency?
Not really. I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas, and spent the first 42 years of my life in that venue, but toward the late 80s and early 90s, as managed care moved in and the practice of medicine progressively began changing, which is now really accelerating, I became dissatisfied with working at six hospitals and being in the car 2 hours a day, and the just the pressures of urban life. I had a friend who was a radiologist up here in Kansas. We used to vacation up here with our kids, and there's such a, you know, kind of healthy, nice environment. I kiddingly said, well, if you ever find somebody that needs a job up here, let me know. And sure enough, he called and said that McPherson Hospital probably would close if their retiring surgeons weren't replaced. And I went up just to be, polite, really, not thinking I would leave the big city. And I kind of fell in love with the small town and the people, and I suddenly had that sense of mission that I could do something really significant here. So within 6 months or so, I packed up my bags and with a U-Haul trailer arrived in a town of 13,000. I was unpacking my belongings in the rent house when the phone rang, and one of my future family practice associates said, I know you're not working yet. And in the background, I heard, well, the hemoglobin's 6.2 now. And I was immediately drawn into the hospital where I saw my first case of placenta procreta and had to try to stop a massively bleeding patient in a small hospital with 2 units of blood on hand. And did my first emergency hysterectomy of my career, and spent about 30 hours in the ICU afterwards thinking, what have I gotten myself into? And when she left the hospital 5 days later, well, I thought, now this is pretty cool. And it hasn't, every day's not like that, but it's, it's been a very rewarding career. So I'm pretty darn happy with my choice.
Well, you know, it sounds like a lot of great careers, and especially the places you work, start with these really crazy, complicated cases right off the bat. We've heard that. We've been doing this quite some time, and a lot of people explain that exact same scenario, which is great. You know, Dr. Hughes, the question I have for you is that did you grow up in like a smaller town? Did you have any idea what rural surgery was before you even moved to Kansas?
Well, I grew up in Garland, Texas, which is a small town back at that time. And so I guess I always had kind of a favoritism towards smaller towns. Actually, after finishing residency, I wanted to go to a small town in Colorado. But when my mentor, Dr. Polis, asked if I'd stay on and help with the surgery residency, you know, it's kind of like the president asking me if he would serve, you know, yes, sir.
Yeah.
And that set the tone for the next 12 years.
Have you been noticing the shortage that's oncoming with rural surgeons? Have you seen it on your level or as the advisory council for the American College of Surgeons?
Well, I would say it's not coming. It's here. You know, 5-10 years ago, we were talking, hey, we're going to be in trouble, and now it's actually here. And I would say in my area, Central Kansas, has really come home to us very recently, and that our surrounding area with the other somewhat larger hospital a little ways away, we have a 90,000-person catchment area. We're soon going to be down to 3 general surgeons for 90,000 people.
Wow.
And that's gonna sting. And I'm not sure that it's one thing to cover 30,000 people every other night, but you get up to 90,000 every other night or every third night, you know, it may not be sustainable. And that will become the self-fulfilling prophecy that, you know, it gets people like the work, but they can't get away from the work because it's like being at one of the inner city hospitals where there's always another need and you can't turn it off. That's why we need to recruit to the areas or find ways to make sure these patients are safely cared for, both on an urgent and elective basis. I think the other problem, I'm sort of rambling, but the other problem is that, you know, out here in the lower population areas, the patients really need what I call surgical cognition. And that's being aware that there is a surgical problem even in existence and how to attack that problem. As much as I like my family practitioner friends who help me and they're very good at what they do, yeah, they just don't have that surgical depth of understanding. And to them, a hot gallbladder just is another gallbladder, not one that's gangrenous and is about to die if you don't do something. So, you know, it's not just the operating, it's also the diagnosis and bringing to the rural population, you know, more expertise on how to get out of their jams that they find themselves in.
Now, Dr. Hughes, there's a lot of editorials and studies floating around out there and suggesting the reasons why there's a shortage in the rural populations for general surgeons. In your own opinion, why is this a shortage and why aren't there residents and going to practice in rural medicine? And this is for all specialties.
Well, some of this is kind of the law of unintended consequences. You know, throughout the post-World War II era, we've increasingly specialized in surgery, and general surgery, which used to be the king of the hill, is no longer the dominant force in surgery. It's incredibly important, but, you know, because of the successes in cardiovascular and other specialties, appropriately so, general surgery is just another option for students. And some of those options are very lucrative, and they're in big cans with large dollar signs behind them, a lot of prestige. And so medical students and residents, being as intelligent as they are, tended to gravitate to those things. And slowly but surely, the brain drain from the rural and intermediate sized areas kept deepening to the point that, as I'm sure everybody's aware, there's a lot of concern about the status of general surgery as a specialty. The American Board of Surgery is very concerned about this and looking at redesigning the way residencies are done and fellowships for general surgery and rural surgery in order to shore up what is perceived, at least in some places, as a lack of ability by the general surgery specialty. The other thing is we tend to admit people in medical school and residency based on their high intellectual capabilities, and we forget their demographics. Interestingly, if you come from a small town, now I didn't, but lots of them do, or your spouse comes from a smaller rural area, you're much more likely to come back. So part of this is to identify those people who, in the long run, may likely return to rural environment because they feel that sense of personal mission for it. Now, I will tell you that the pendulum is beginning to swing, but because of the desperation to care for these patients, general surgical practices are being highly sought after, and the monetary reward being offered for someone who will go to the less populated place is going up and up and up, whereas someone who has finished advanced, say, hepatobiliary or breast or trauma critical care fellowship, or finding that in Dallas, Chicago, San Francisco, they have enough. And it's getting harder and harder for those subspecialists to find adequate places in the job market. So I think the opinion will swing. The problem is, will it swing before we lose the infrastructure needed to do this safely?
Great. And I know there are some incentives that they do for primary care specialties, like loan paybacks and things. And one of the things you mentioned was, you know, getting people into med school that are from small towns. Are there any of those incentive programs for surgical residencies to pay back loans if you go work in a small town for 5 or 10 years after residency that you've seen?
At the federal level, there have been attempts to do that. The trouble is, in our current political environment, spending any money is immediately voted down. And while the family practitioners and OB-GYN pediatrician groups have said, yeah, we'll share with the general surgeons, it requires legislation to do that. That's been difficult. For a while, we had a 10% bump in payments if you're in a medically underserved area for your specialty, and that helped. And I will tell you, you know, exclusive of government programs, if you're being recruited to a rural area, frequently part of the package is, oh, you have loans? How would you like us to make those go away? And so on the private level, at the individual hospital district level, I think there's some relief for that. And that's not generally understood by someone who's just coming out of a residency, unless they've been looking at it for a while.
Yeah, we've always, you know, in the medical school and even residency training, most of these programs are based around cities and things like that. So I think a lot of residents don't actually have a good idea what a day in the life of rural practice is. Can you give us some idea of what your typical week is?
Well, I'm officially at work 4.5 days a week. So Thursday afternoons, I'll take off so I can get a haircut or attend to, you know, my usual business. As you mentioned, I'm on call every other night. Rural call is either awfully simple or simply awful. And usually it's pretty simple. It's not that you're up every night doing a placenta procreta. But when you do have to come in, it's usually, it really means something. And you have to be prepared for almost anything from a multi-trauma MVA case to ruptured aneurysm to just an appendix. When the phone rings, you know, there's no filter for the rural surgeon. So it may be a nail through somebody's hand, or it may be a shotgun blast to the arm, and you don't know when the phone rings. So you have to be prepared all the time. So a lot of study. I probably reserve an hour or two a day to study, to stay up on my broad-based, capabilities. And then I'll usually operate in the morning starting at 7:30. A lot of endoscopy cases, as matter, opening laparoscopic cases. Afternoons, I see clinics until 5 or 6 at night, in which we get hit with an emergency, and then we tear up the clinic and go to the operating room. So it's kind of, you never know when you wake up in the morning what you're going to be doing. And for my personality, I like that. Because I remember when I was doing cardiovascular rotation residency, I was so sick and tired of the same operation over and over that I really appreciate the variety that rural practice gives me. Weekends are usually fairly light if you're on call. But again, you never know. I would say that now that I've become more involved in leadership, I spend a lot of nights and weekends, working on ACS policy and board policy. So I'm a little different than most rural surgeons in that regard, is that I have that additional time. Before all that started, I used to fly my airplane a couple of times a week, and sometimes I would fly to another town and help another surgeon with a bigger case, and that was a lot of fun. So you can kind of make the life what you want it to be in the rural world, depending on the infrastructure around you.
One of the things I was wondering, so we were going to ask you if you do scopes. It sounds like you do a good amount of endoscopy. Do you guys have a GI practitioner at your hospital, or are you the end game for endoscopy?
No, we're the end game. Just like all specialists, there aren't very many specialists in the rural environment. So I do probably 200 to 300 screening colonoscopies a year. There always seems to be a GI bleed coming in every few days. So I do interventional endoscopy for GI bleeds and dilated esophagi. Most of the things that you would do as a surgical endoscopist, I try to avoid, getting involved in celiac sprue and long-range treatment of ulcerative colitis. But frequently I'm the first one to diagnose an ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease because of my endoscopy expertise. And I must say that the surrounding GI guys, I think they're relatively appreciative that they don't have to do every scope in the world, and that I can help protect them from all the food boluses on Thanksgiving and the other holidays. So it's a cooperative effort, but certainly most rural surgeons, anywhere from 20% to 50% of their practice will involve a scope in some way.
One of the things we see out here at Madigan, as well as we rotate up at Harborview, we see a lot of transfers coming from, the Pacific Northwest, from the most rural states. And these are often the points where they're critically ill. And the question I have for you is, how do you decide where to draw the line as far as complexity? When do you know when to push this up to a larger center for further care?
Experience is a great teacher. I would say that everybody who's going to be dead by the time they get to the major center has to stay with me. If they have a ruptured aneurysm and they're in shock and bleeding out, I'm not going to make them more well by putting them in an ambulance or a helicopter. Mm-hmm. Same thing, not all that long ago, someone accidentally ran into a knife and had a hole in the cave and was bleeding out. And it's kind of like when they say, when do you not operate on a coronary patient? Well, if it's a big emergency, no matter what their coronary status is, you still do the emergency. The intelligent thing is to always keep in contact with your major center that I'm doing this, I'm going to stabilize this patient, and then they're coming to you as fast as I can get them there. So that's sort of the emergency side of things. And certainly diverticulitis, appendicitis, cholecystitis, perforated ulcers, obstructing cancers are pretty much within the realm of a competent general surgeon, as long as they don't have 10 comorbidities. And so I use the NISQIP risk calculator a fair amount to look at, you know, where we're going with the comorbidities. Because those are really what bite you in a small environment. Anybody can do the operation as a competent general surgeon, but you got to remember you're going to be the guy doing the post-op care. That's the ventilators, the vasopressors, the central lines, the chest tubes. And there are two factors there. Number one is how much of the resource are you soaking up so that other lesser cases can't get into you. And then exhausting your resources, your respiratory therapists and your ICU nurses that you have. Because if you exhaust those resources, then you've kind of turned off your hospital. So for me, transfers are based on, you know, how long is this going to run post-op? How many comorbidities are there? And, you know, obviously, do I have the technical expertise to do this? There's an old saying that you've seen one rural hospital situation, you've seen one. And that's very true. So many rural surgeons actually have a fellowship or two under their belt. One of my ex-partners had a thoracic fellowship under his belt, so he could do thoracic cases like a whiz. So sometimes the local expertise is more than we think, but you've got to always be aware of what your capabilities are, but not just yours, the entire infrastructure around you. And then the other thing is, I think it's just a sin to transport corpses. If they're dying and you're the only person who can help them, you've got to do what you can.
Great. One question I was thinking of with out having the interventionalist GI guys, the pendulum, at least at some of the big academic centers, has shifted with choledochal lithiasis, where, you know, everyone's afraid to do a transcystic exploration or just flush the duct. If you have a patient that comes in with, you know, maybe some mild choledochal lithiasis, that's not super sick, what is your algorithm? Do you just send those guys straight out to someone that can decompress them with the ERCP, or are you trying to manage these operatively?
What I will do is a perfect question, because just a week or so ago, very similar thing. A patient had a bilirubin of around 4, and his enzymes were up a little bit, and it was the teeter-totter between, is this gangrenous cholecystitis with Marinci syndrome, or is it choledochal lithiasis? So in a case where I have a big dilated common duct and they obviously see stones on the sono, I have ERCP capability within an hour from me, and I will send those for ERCP. And at that other hospital, they'll either do what we refer to as a docking procedure, where they do the gallbladder and the ERCP all at the same whack, or they'll send them back to me for the gallbladder later. I wouldn't have any fear at all that if it was a gangrenous gallbladder with a great big common duct and I didn't have the ERCP available to me, I would take him in and do whatever exploration, either transcystic or open classic common bile duct exploration. But you got to remember, I trained in the era where we did a lot of common duct exploration, so the open one doesn't scare me very much. Fortunately, remember, that's only going to be 5%, 1%. So as time goes by, this is not being a common scenario. By the way, my patient from the other week, we got in there and he had to be done open because he had an absolutely dead gallbladder, and his bilirubin went down when we stopped the inflammation around the porta.
Now, Dr. Hughes, are you employed by the hospital out there or a private practice? I think you might have mentioned this already.
When I left private practice in Dallas, I enjoyed doing payroll and business stuff so much that I decided I never wanted to do that again. I mean, just have the OSHA people throw down the regs around your office and you'll wish you hadn't been born. So I really was never a good businessman in the sense of enjoying the business aspect. So when I came up here, I asked to be employed. And one of my proposals in terms of being a salary position was I didn't want to work for a proprietary hospital, having had some experience with that. And I really wanted to be working for a community-based hospital because they plow all their money back into trying to keep the hospital afloat and doing well. And that's in general worked out real well for me. I haven't suffered the slings and arrows of contract negotiations as much as my compadres in the urban environment. One of the reasons is when you're the only one of two and the hospital's about 12 or 15% of their total revenues depending on you being there, they tend to treat you as a well thought of commodity, as opposed to if you're in Dallas, they could just say, well, we have 500 general surgeons who would like your job. That's not the case in the rural environment. It's much more collaborative when it comes to contract negotiations.
Do you foresee rural medicine, like which side do you think it would go, more of a hospital base or private practice base in the future?
I think it's going to be just like everywhere. It's all going to be 80 to 90% either hospital base or salaried. Okay. We're sitting right now at 70% of all surgeons are on salary in some way, employed. I don't like using the term employed surgeon because does that mean if you're in private practice, you don't have a job? But it's, you know, a salaried or employment contract. That's what everything's going to. And it's because trying to stay in private practice, facing down that barrage of regulatory burden, unless you're in a really big group and you can afford to hire an army of people to take care of that. That's rural surgery, you know, they're two or four together trying to make a go of it. We can't hire an MBA to run the logistics of a practice like I could in Dallas.
And one final question, sir. This is important to all residents and doctors out there, and you kind of alluded to it, but it sounds like the pay is becoming more attractive for people to go into rural surgery as, you know, the cities become saturated. And do you foresee that continuing to have a more attractive salary options if you start off in rural versus a city-based practice?
Well, let me understand your question. I actually think one scenario we could see is that people started off in urban and beginning to chafe under the yoke of corporate medicine, may turn to the rural environment fondly. And so that's one hope for repopulating the rural environment. But I do think that there's a tipping point. At present, there's sufficient money in many of the rural hospitals to offer attractive salaries. But if we lose so many rural hospitals so that they no longer have the safe ability to provide surgery, no amount of money is worth going to a place that can't do what you need to do. I think it'll be interesting to see how the next 5 to 10 years plays out. Long term, a generation from now, I think we're going to, and I hope to be a part of this, is to generate a more rural surgery system, sort of like the trauma system, where everybody knows what their role is, that transfers are easily accomplished between them so that the patient gets the best possible care closest to home and gets back to home as fast as possible. So while there's a lot of doom and gloom about how tough things are right now, ultimately, those kind of economic and social pressures are the things that can bring us to a better tomorrow. Knowing some of my friends like Brent Eastman and the rest who helped start the trauma systems, everybody thought that was the craziest idea in the world, to have a trauma system, until it actually became apparent that it was a great way to take care of trauma. I hope that's the way things will turn out. I certainly hope to try to use my influence to help that. And that doesn't mean I'm going to tell hospitals they can't operate. I'm going to help them understand how they can be part of the system and make it work better for everybody.
And our final question, just for our listeners out there, can you tell us a operation that you have done, or maybe not necessarily an operation, but a patient that you've cared for in the past year or two that you can be pretty sure that the city surgeon has not seen ever in their career?
You know that knife one I told you about. When we finished fixing the cava, that we're still bleeding, I said, well, why is this vein coming straight up at me? Not only did he have a cable injury, he had an SMB injury with a complete malocation of the gut. Okay. I don't think you see that every day. and stuff like that, just, I'll carry another one. So, I don't know if this is fit for public consumption. You can edit it out if you don't.
No, we love
it. So one day I was in our little ER doing CPR on a very unfortunate teenager who had been rolled over by a truck. And obviously, we were just trying our last efforts on this. And as I'm giving CPR, the ER doctor comes in and says, Dr. Hughes, when you're finished, I've got a really bad case in the next room. And I look up at him doing CPR going, worse than this? And I walked over to the other room, and there was about 4 feet of small bowel hanging out this lady's vagina.
Oh, my
God. She had ruptured an interosseal and eviscerated through her vagina. She left the hospital 5 days later. Of course, I wouldn't tell you a story if she died. But what was interesting is, you kind of look at that and go, okay, we're going to have to do something here. I think we'll put everything back in and start sewing. And, she did very well. She was probably 80 or so and lived another 4 or 5 years, just happy as a clam, never got infected. I have no idea why she didn't get abscesses from that. But it's quite interesting.
Well, doctors, that was an awesome story, and that was a great rundown of your rural practice, and I appreciate you taking your time out of your day to be on Behind the Knife. And like I said, we're planning on interviewing a few more rural surgeons, trying to get the word out there, as well as just get an idea with this world we don't all see very often. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. All right, off now. I've got to go tap a chest. So that's my next thing. You guys take care of.
Well, we hope you enjoyed our interview with Dr. Tyler Hughes. Like I mentioned, next week is with Dr. Gary Timmerman, and we'll hear a different perspective on rural surgery. Upcoming at Behind the Knife, we have another multi-part series involving global surgery, as well as a bunch of excellent guests we have yet to publish. So stay tuned.
Until next time, dominate the day.